Good morning to you. Turn, if you would, to the book of Exodus. We are in the 20th chapter of the book of Exodus. We are finishing up a little short series on the Ten Commandments. I'm glad you're with us this morning. The Ten Commandments. I want to mention again how much that I've been greatly helped and appreciate the Sinai Code by Andy Stanley, and that's been a part of the basis for my working through this, and so I want to make sure that I give credit where it is. The Ten Commandments are given to a group of people that God has just set free, and He gives the Ten Commandments to keep them free. Now, that's really, really important that you understand that. If you have an understanding that God is some narrow cosmic killjoy who's just trying to give you laws and regimens to keep you away from having a good life, man, you're clueless on who this God really is. In fact, the context for the Ten Commandments is very much, if you had a God who loved you and a God who wanted to protect you and a God who wants to look after you, what would He say to you? Well, the answer is these things. There's a basic principle that you need to understand. They come out of the concept of God's pouring His love out to you. It's an interesting little sideline, by the way. Road signs are now under the auspices of the government. They put them up. But road signs existed for centuries. And even when people were first driving in this country, the government didn't put up road signs. Road signs were always erected by neighbors. They were things like danger, yield, sharp curve. Things like stop, blind corner. And who put the signs up? The answer is neighbors put them up for neighbors. It was an act of love. It was an act of kindness. Now, if you read a road sign and you think a neighbor put it up, or you think the government put it up, what's your attitude? Well, the answer is, wow, I have no problem if a neighbor is trying to tell me something. In fact, it might be irresponsible on the neighbor's part not to tell me that. Well, lo and behold, when you approach Scripture, you have to come from the same perspective, which is what? I have a God who loves me and redeems me, and the God who's done so did not do it to put me under His thumb and demonstrate some kind of personal power. It is His very voice of love. We talked about this principle, that relationship always precedes rules. And so if you have a relationship with God, that God established for them in Egypt, and they begin to understand His great love for them, what follows relationship is rules. And that always works. But if you reverse it, it never works. Never, never, never works. You reverse the order of those things, and you put rules first, and there is no relationship, but you say, well, if you do the rules long enough, you'll get a relationship. You know, you don't get that. You get rebellion. Rules without relationship lead to rebellion. That's why there are kids in this auditorium. I don't know what the future holds, but I can tell you a principle. You can bring your kids and put them in Bible school class, and you can try to teach them to love God. You can do so out of your family. But if your kids never establish their own relationship with God, with a sweetness of understanding who He is, then the stories they will tell about your home is just regimented rules, and you drug them to church, and you made them to listen to bad preachers, which may be true anyhow, but you just made all these horrible things happen, and you're going, well, where did they get that mindset? Because without a relationship, the rules just always lead to rebellion. The flip side's what families do. We love one another. We take good care of one another, and these are some rules which we do it. And that's the context. On these Ten Commandments, the first four are all based around this idea. The first four of the Ten Commandments are these. I want to be your God, and I want you to be my people. The second one, I want to be your everywhere, everything God. Don't shrink me down to some kind of religion. Don't minimize me. Don't make me a backpack God. I want to be your everywhere. I want you to be in my hip pocket, and I want to be in your hip pocket. Number three, don't use me or my name for anything that I'm not about. Don't try to leverage my name. Don't try to go about your own agenda and say, God, God, God. No, 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 no. Don't do that. That's so disrespectful. Be about the things I'm about and don't use my name on things I'm not about. On the fourth one, trust me. Build your whole rhythm of life and its life schedule around your trust in me. Trust me that I'll give you 7 days provisions and 6 days of labor. And I want you to drive a stake in the ground every week where you say, look, I trust God, and I build my life around that. And now we come to Exodus, the 20th chapter, and we are going to, in the last one, cover the remaining ones. And you say, that's a lot. No, it really, I think it'll make sense. Would you stand for the reading of the text today? Exodus 20. We're just going to read from verse 12 down to verse 17, which finishes up the Ten Commandments. Verse 12, honor your father and your mother so that you may live long in the land the Lord your God is giving you. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not give false testimony against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife or his manservant or his maidservant, his ox or his donkey or anything that belongs to your neighbor. You may be seated. Here's what he says, unmistakable. He said, you want to know what my will for your life is? It's pretty simple. Everyone you come into contact with is valuable to me. Treat them right. Everybody you bump into, everybody you see, everybody you know, every other relationship you will ever have, those people matter to me. Treat them right. Look around you. You see a human being, they matter. And he'll talk specific. You can't steal from anyone. I don't care who you are. I don't care how powerful you think you are. I don't care how much you devalue who you think they are. I'm telling you, you can't steal from anyone. Don't steal another man's wife. Don't steal another man's house. No matter how rich or how powerful you are or who you're related to. You can't lie about anyone. You can't say, oh, they're worthless. That's just the old town drunk. Don't you lie about anybody. Don't you ever consider anybody worthless enough that you could take advantage of them. Jesus in Matthew 25 uses a powerful statement. He says people are divided into two groups, the sheep and the goats. And he begins to describe that the goats that he describes are goats for this reason. That when you came across the poorest of the poor, you didn't do anything. When you came across the prisoner and the sick, you didn't do anything. When you came across, and he goes through this whole list of stuff, you didn't do anything. And when you didn't do anything for them, he was like, not doing anything for me. And those of you that are sheep, the reason I call you sheep is because when you came across the poorest of the poor, the very least of these, you did it to me. You took care of them. You took care of the prisoner and the sick and the poor, and you did it to me. And you look at that passage and go, you mean when we look after the town drunk, when we look after that prisoner, when you look after that poverty-stricken immigrant family, it's like doing it to the Lord. And Jesus goes, yep. And we go, Jesus, that's really strong. Where'd you get that? Well, the answer is, it comes out of the Ten Commandments. It's the thing God said in the very beginning. The thing on the mountain. Do you understand all human beings have value in my sight? And if you don't value human beings up to the level that I ask you to value them, it is me you're at war with. You mistreat the town drunk, you're at war with me. You ignore the poorest of the poor and you do not invest in them, you're at war with me in this issue. We sang a song, most of us did when we were little kids, a song of red and yellow, black and white. They are precious in his sight. That was easy to sing as little kids. Trouble is, these non-cute adults were having trouble with. And lo and behold, it comes along the Ten Commandments and says, here's my will for you. Here's the most loving thing I can tell you. You treat everyone with the dignity and worth and value as somebody who matters. That's pretty radical. You know that no place on the face of the earth would practice that. Hadn't practiced it before and wouldn't practice it for thousands of years. If God hadn't intervened and come from the outside and said, this is the truth, no one here would have picked up on it. You want to know why? because it's the nature of kings to do what they want. It's the nature of generals and armies to do what they want. It's the nature of the rich to do what they want. It's the nature of the mob to do what it wants. It's the nature of an ethnic group to do what it wants to others. It's the nature of everybody in this world to say, those of us that are on top have some advantage to use those who are underneath. And God says, not in my land. And not in my church. And not in my people. The Ten Commandments have two parts. One always leads to the other. The first part is this. It's the first four. Treat God with the respect and honor due him, which will always lead to the second part. And so you'll treat everybody else with respect. And you won't degrade anyone. But if you miss the first part, I mean, that was God's intent. But if you miss the first part, and you lose respect for God, I guarantee you, you'll lose this. There are people in this room, and I don't know who they are. Good grief, I'm speaking in generalities. But there are people in this room. You're meaner than snakes. I mean, you're just mean. You're mean in your language. You're mean in your words. You're mean with the rolling of your eyes. You're mean with the face. There are people in this room that you degrade people on a consistent basis. You want to know where that comes from? It is the fruit of not having an appropriate and right view of God. And because of that, you're tough to live with. On the other hand, there are people in this room who your nature would have been to be as mean as snakes. But somehow your encounter with the living God and your understanding who he is changed everything. And the people who live with you are living out the fruit of a man or woman or 15-year-old girl or boy who knows how to honor God and take good care of other people. You realize, don't you, that this really swims upstream to human life. This is not how we know it from history. In fact, God encounters his people and says, this is how we'll live. We'll value everyone. Equal value. It wasn't until 1776 that another group of people really tried this. I'm not trying to make some revisionist history. I'm just telling you, it's still true. It wasn't until 1776 that other people tried this. You see, in 1774 and 75 and 76, a series of phenomenal documents that come out of what's called the Judeo-Christian ethic. What's that mean? It came from an ethic that God himself brings. And one of those phenomenal documents, not inspired of God in the sense that it came directly from the mountain. No, it's men. But one of those documents that you're pretty familiar with says that all men are created equal. And are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among them are life and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. You know what that means? That means the immigrant is every bit as important and his life matters every bit as much as the rich man on top of the hill. That means the man who owns, that he owns the factory, has the same value as the man who shows up with his lunchbox to work in the factory. It means the woman who has not been given the opportunity for education, she has the same value and needs to be treated with the same dignity as the person who teaches the local college. It means the handicapped, not worth much to society by what they can produce if you're going to put them on that value, but the handicapped, a human being, has this same incredible value. The idea that there'll be no king who imposes his will on you, there's no monarchy to impose their will on you, there's no ruling class who's over you, that everyone has worth and values, what this country tried to do as a grand experiment. And it came out of what God himself has said. The exact same thing. Now, we had a great hypocrisy. We had a terrible hypocrisy. When we said all human beings are created equal, we said, okay, except those that work on our plantations and those who are different skin color than we are and people that we can make some money for us. And we had the greatest rip this country has ever seen over the great hypocrisy of slavery. And we had more bloodshed than you can imagine because we violated the very principle that we said we believed in. And slavery, the great blight. But we came out of it with this. All human beings have equal value. Here's the basic premise. Let me just give us just a very simple premise of what it means to be a Christian and how you understand. The premise is this: there's a lawgiver, and the lawgiver sets the standard for everyone, and there's lawkeepers. And that every lawkeeper is under the same standard of the lawgiver. And the lawkeeper is to understand that the lawgiver has said that a human being is worth more than you could imagine. And you treat every human being with worth and value. And that's what this is about. We deal with countries all the time that have regular human rights violations. And we go to those places and we say, good grief, you can't do that. You can't have child prostitution. You can't treat the prisoners that way. You can't do that with those ethnic tribes of yours. You can't do that. You're violating human rights. And those countries look back at us puzzled and go, what? Well, of course we can. We're in charge. Because in their paradigm, there's lawgivers and lawkeepers. And it's just a big battle to see who gets to be the lawgiver. And whoever's the lawgiver gets to set whatever laws you want. And if you have the might and the right and the power and the mob and the group and the guns, if you can articulate it, if you're smarter, brighter, better looking, then you could be the lawgiver. And the lawgiver can do what he wants. You're just trying to be our lawgiver. Get out of our country. You can't be our lawgiver. And our answer, if we have integrity, is no, we're not your lawgiver either. We all are under a lawgiver, and he exists outside. We're all lawkeepers. And the worth and value of a human being. Here's a funny thing about being a lawgiver. If you think you're the lawgiver, let me tell you, you get a free pass on your own laws. You know that, don't you? You get a free pass on your own laws if you think you're a lawgiver. For example, in our house, it has always been a rule and a law that you don't drink the milk that's left over after the cereal. You don't drink it directly from the bowl. I've gotten on to kids. I've snapped my fingers at Troy or Katie or Megan and said, no, don't do that. It's a law I've set, and I'm pretty firm on it. Until the kids aren't around, and I've got milk in the bottom of my bowl. You see, being a lawgiver gives you the right to sort of circumvent the law. But I mean, I only do it when kids aren't around or when I think they have their backs turned. But I am the lawgiver, and I'm serious on this, and I mean it. I'm serious. I'm serious. And God comes along and says, Randy, I want you to know in your encounters with other human beings, you will never, ever, ever be the lawgiver. You may be the law enforcer and the police or something, but you'll never be the lawgiver. Randy, you are under me. Randy, you're under me. You want to know why the great battle that's occurring is both political and non-political on issues like poverty and abortion? And that's why it's so confusing even at times. You see, truth is, are we going to be a nation who's under a lawgiver who says that all human beings have worth? Or are we going to fight a battle to see who's going to have the majority so that the law majority can have it and the majority can be the lawgivers? And that's what makes this really confusing. And that's why even comes down, it doesn't matter what the majority said or the king has said, it does come down to what has the lawgiver said. I'm a lawkeeper under the lawgiver. And it becomes a bit complex. All the Ten Commandments say, and all the rest of them, is Randy, there will never be a time in your life that your prestige or your status or your money or your racial group, nothing will ever bring you to the place that you can't take good care of everybody else. Every person has value, and that's what this is about. He's going to begin with a series of specific things. Let me just mention them. He will say, honor your father and mother. You want to know how to work this out, and it'll sort of work from an inside circle out. You want to know where you start respecting? You honor your father and mother. You start in your own home. Let me just comment briefly this morning that I realize that the handoff of childhood to adulthood is not easy. In the best of families, the handoff from childhood to adulthood is it's a little hard. Taking the baton that was in the hand of a little 12-year-old or 9-year-old or 13-year-old, and you were helping with the baton, and you held it, and they looked at it. But when they become whatever age that is, and that's some discussion we could have as well, but handing that baton where now they have their own adulthood, that's not easy. The best of families find bumps and bruises in there. But you can always tell the difference between the wise and the fool. You can always tell the difference between the godly and the ungodly. That the wise will make that transition from childhood to adulthood, and they will make it in ways that are still respectful and honoring to their parents. And the fool will always make that transition where their esteem and their honor for their parents are too low. You'll notice in this passage it doesn't say honor your father and mother if they're great parents. Truth is, parenting's a pretty complex business. There's not the best parents in this room. If we could go through and find the best parents in this room and had them come and sit here for a second, and we looked at the very best parents, that set of parents would tell you we've stumbled on so many things. Being a parent's a bit of a high wire act. You love your kids and you do what's best, but you regret and you wish you'd have done that different. You wish your tone of voice was different. The best parents in this room will struggle and do stupid and silly things. He never said to youth, he never said to grown adults, honor your parents if your parents were really, really honorable people in every way. Because then I'd have to just measure and go, okay, do they deserve honor or not? No, you don't understand. Every human being, even the parents who failed in many, many ways, there's a level of respect and honor that you got to do. Let me make a true statement that Jay said here in front. Both of us would stand here and tell you we've worked with people till the world looks level. We cannot find anybody who has lived dishonorable lives with their parents who've lived honorable lives in all the other ways. You find people who live honorable lives even with bad parents. I'll show you somebody who God will use, and their star will shine bright, and there's tremendous, powerful things. But if somebody does not figure out how to give respect and honor, Katie bar the door, she's a tough world ahead. I'll go so far as to say this last week, one of the most painful things that my wife and I had was to have a set of parents who are sobbing and their shoulders are shaking and sitting there, and a stone-faced child. And you watch that exchange and you go, oh, bless our hearts. It is a loving God who said, you want to know how life works best? Do you want to know how you work best? You start always with this. I will say to you, I don't even know where the kids are sitting. In fact, let me make this little observation too, by the way. I am really glad when families sit together as much as possible. Now, I think your kids' friends ought to be able to sit with you as well and all those things. But I will really tell you, just from being a kid, I know where we sit. I would really encourage families to sit together as much as possible. But let me say to every kid in this room, if you are dating a boy, girls, if you're dating a boy who does not live at a high level of respect and honor to his parents, run. Run. You have no idea the disastrous consequences will come. You're dating a boy who cannot be respectful and doesn't treat with honor his parents, even his foolish, yeah, but his dad's an alcoholic. I understand that. But there's a level of respect and honor. If he can't do that, sweetheart, you're in for a terrible roller coaster ride with this guy. I would say to every guy in this room, I don't care how pretty she is. I don't care how gorgeous she is. I don't care how talented she is. If she cannot live with respect and honor, if you cannot admire the godliness by which she interacts with her mom or her dad, I'm going to tell you, that is one of the ugliest girls you'll ever meet in your life. And the consequences of that will be far beyond what you can ever dream or imagine. The Ten Commandments are not fluff stuff. Oh, thank you. The Ten Commandments are not fluff stuff. The Ten Commandments come down, do you know how to center your life around the living God? And out of that will flow your understanding of everything else. He'll move further down in this text and get on to other things. He will say in verse 13, you shall not murder. Basically, here's what he's saying. Do you realize, don't you, that the lives and bodies of other people to be respected? I don't care how bad they are. I don't care how mad you get. I don't care what they do. You shall not, don't you murder. This passage, this word murder in particular here, the word kill, is really about the idea of getting your own revenge, about you enacting something because of what they have done to you. He's going to say in verse 14, you honor their marriages. He's going to say in verse 15, you honor their possessions. In verse 16, he's going to say you honor their reputations. So their lives, their marriages, their possessions, their reputations, I don't care who you are, you don't have the right to take it. And you'll deal with God. You know, it's a funny little thing. We have forgotten our accountability to God. And I wondered, as I was preparing this, I wondered what God would sit down with me when I meet with Him. And I wondered the names that God would know of people that I've taken advantage of. And I wondered what God would say, Randy, I have watched your life, and this is what you... There is no worthless person you can take advantage of. It's in this text. The last one is an invisible command. The last one's kind of interesting. It's an invisible command in the sense that you can't call the police on this one. Yeah, I mean, you can call the police on one of the earlier ones. Hey, they came and stole my car. Can you imagine the police call on this last one? Have you seen the last one here? You shall not covet. You pick a phone up and call the police. Hey, he drove by my house and they were coveting. I could tell. They were looking at my three-car garage. You arrest those people. Well, what's he mean in this? Here's what he says. He uses the word covet, which means to strongly desire, to lust after. God said, I want you to respect so deeply that even how you think about other people is respectful. I want you to think so deeply. Here's an amazing thing. That I will be held accountable to God not only for what I do, but for what I think about doing. That I will be held accountable to God not only for how I behave, but how I imagine behaving. Why would God say that? The answer is, it's impossible to keep a good relationship with people who you begin to dehumanize and covet what they have. And I mean, so ultimately, it's the first domino in a lot of things. But it's His great love for you. I don't know if you've seen it or not. I've only seen it in cartoons, and I've never seen it in real life, and I hope never to, obviously. But you've seen the cartoon where the poor old dog gets leash got tied to the bumper of the car. And that cartoon's got the car going down, and that, I mean, you know how they do on cartoons. I mean, that dog is running like crazy, and that dog is almost flying, its ears flapping, and that dog's just trying to keep up so desperately. Anybody here who lives with an undisciplined mind, and you do not discipline your mind, your life is like that dog tied to the bumper. Whatever follows is out of control, chasing, it will destroy you, you be tossed from one end to the other. Those of you who will discipline your mind, that I will live at peace in my trust in living God and how He teaches me, you'll live a life that everybody else will envy. And they'll covet your life because of a disciplined mind. And we finish the Ten Commandments. Let me just point out one last thing. I want you to notice the last set of verses. It's just interesting to me. Verse 18. And when the people saw the thunder and the lightning, and they heard the trumpet, and they saw the mountain and smoke, they trembled with fear. And they stayed at a distance and said to Moses, speak to us yourself, and we will listen, but don't have God speak to us, or we'll die. Moses said to the people, do not be afraid.
God has come to test you so that the fear of God will be with you to keep you from sinning. And the people remained at a distance while Moses approached the thick darkness where God was. So here you got this, given the Ten Commandments, and then God says to them, now don't be afraid. What? Do you think the pronouncement through Moses of don't be afraid settled anything? Good grief. Glad you said that. No, I'm guessing that the fear was still there. But he makes a contrast in the text. Did you notice that? There's a contrast in the text between being afraid and having fear. Why does God make that sort of a distinction between don't be afraid, which, by the way, is almost always what the angels always say. It's what God always says when you come into recognition. Don't be afraid. But it's okay to fear. Why? Afraid is a set of emotions that are out of control. I don't know what's going to happen next. No. Settle your emotions down. Be fine. But have fear, because the substance and the reality of God is not some kind of hypothetical thing. There it is. You see the fire. You see the smoke. You see the presence. It's okay to have fear because the reality is really there. If you understand the reality of God, I promise you, these Ten Commandments are things you'll run to and want to hang on to, because they're the voice of a God who I fear and respect and I honor and I'm in awe of and I bow down to and I'm in wonder over. But if you have no fear of God, then you have no relationship with Him. And all of this is just religious gobbledygook, and we filled a few mornings in and we kind of went over some stuff, and you'll go home and it is your encounter with God that determines whether these have any substance or not. I regularly say at all my weddings, in fact, it's almost always, I talk about rings. I talk about how a ring at a wedding has no intrinsic value of its own. It really doesn't. A jeweler will set a value on it, but ultimately rings have a value because the substance behind it, if my wife loves me and is committed to me, and my wife, in her character, in her life, in my marriage, then my ring has value. But if my wife pulls out her love and her all those things, then this ring just becomes symbolic of nothing. My wife gives this ring value. The Ten Commandments only have value for people in a relationship with the living God who know how to fear Him. They're worthless to anybody who doesn't know Him. The reason we would offer an invitation to Him is there are people in this room, you know you don't know Him. We'd love to study with you. We'd love to talk with you. We'd love to sit down. We'd love to answer objections you might have in your own mind. We'd love to help you work through the process that you come to know Him, that the Ten Commandments might become the greatest road to freedom you ever saw. We'd love to. There's others in this room that you're not sure. There are ministers down here. Elders will be out. We'd love to talk to you. Maybe you know today is the day that you ought to say, I give up my resistance. I have fought against my Creator and Redeemer long enough. It's time to change. Would you come? We give an invitation to a relationship. Would you be one of the kids of God? You'll never, ever regret it. Would you stand as we sing?